Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015. An environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of 4 young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. 4 killed for what?
Welcome to today's edition of the program. My name is Tony Bruschi. We're recording this on the 15th of December of 2022. That's the timestamp. So if you're listening to this far later than that, just understand what we're talking about is the information that we have at this moment. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any updates on the show, full episodes, and breaking updates as we get them. Today, we're going to be talking with an individual that can help us shed some light on the evidence that's being collected or has been collected and what they may be looking for and what it all means to the case, what weight different things hold. An evidence specialist with Evidence Room Forensic Reconstruction in Cleveland, Scott Roeder, going to be joining us in just a few moments. Want to start out, though, with a little bit of new information that has come out in the last 24 hours. We've been discussing the cameras at the gas station that had been voluntarily given and the footage given to police, in which they then shut the gas station down, disassembled one of the gas pumps, assuming there was something with the gas pump they wanted to get out of there. My speculation would be there's usually a camera on a card reader, and maybe they're looking there for more information. We've now learned that within the last week, a liquor store in Moscow, Idaho, has turned over surveillance footage to police. There are cameras both inside and outside of the building, but we did not see what is on those cameras' footage. They have not said what's on the footage, but according to reporter Brian Enton with News Nation, he was told, quote, law enforcement has everything, meaning that they have all the video that they wanted from that store. Not a lot to report as far as updates go at this moment in time. So with that, we're going to go into our conversation here with Scott Roeder. Like I said, evidence specialist with Evidence Room Forensic Reconstruction. Thank you for joining us, Scott. The first question I want to ask, based on your experience, and I know it's kind of a broad question, but I'm sure you can kind of dig into this. What kind of advantages and disadvantages are the investigators up against when diving into a case like this, a big crime scene, a house where people came and went all the time? And obviously, people who are coming and going are not all murderers. So there's a lot of DNA within a scene like this. Again, advantages, disadvantages that they're up against at this point.
Well, I mean, I want to break it up into a couple of different buckets. You know, okay. The first bucket of evidence that is extremely problematic and has a whole range of of difficulties is just the complex nature of the physical and forensic evidence as it sits inside of the crime scene. The very first thing that you look at is what are first responders doing to one, maintain the integrity of the crime scene so that it can be photographed, collected, logged, and then sent out for evaluation. And when you have a scene like this, and I've worked on several multi-residential homicide cases, some bludgeoning, some knife, some gun. And when you have multiple victims' blood mixing with each other, and just to paint a picture of what they stepped into, was just a disaster. There would be so much blood from these four victims and potentially mixed it overlapping with each other because these both of the victims were in beds. My understanding is that Kaylee and Maddie were on the third floor and were both killed in the bed. And then on the second floor, Ethan and
Zainab.
Zaina, yeah, you pronounce it like with a Z, yeah.
Sure.
And Zaina were in that bed. So the blood is going to be all mixed in together. And one of the things investigators are going to want to look at, you know, based on Edwin Locard's, you know, 250-year-old principle of every time you enter a room and leave the room, you leave something behind and you take something with you. That's the basic tenets of forensic science. You're going to want to be looking for hair of the suspect, of the killer, blood of the killer, things the killer left behind, clothes the killer left behind. But when you have the victims mixed in with each other in the same beds, in these tight quarters, and you have their blood mixing and their tissues and hair and clothes all covered in blood and evidence, trying to find something the killer left behind in that complex scene is extremely difficult. Now, we don't have any publicly released photographs of what the inside of that place looked like, but from my experience of working on these kinds of cases, it's going to be like finding a needle in a haystack. So let's say, for example, there's evidence that one of the victims fought back. And I think that there's substantial evidence from things that I've listened to the families say, particularly, not necessarily the police, but what the families have said is that there were defensive wounds. And these weren't just stab wounds, but large gouges in areas of the body that weren't the face. Like, we're talking head and chest, and in some instances, stomach areas. And to be able to find something the killer left behind in that area is going to be really difficult because it's all just going to go together. So the problem that poses is, how do you collect the samples of the blood in sufficient enough of a uncontaminated capsule? I mean, it's just a physical problem.
Yeah.
How do you collect the evidence and separate it as a presumptive positive for individuals so that you can find an anomaly of somebody else's blood, hair, or tissue behind? I think the best chance that they have of finding evidence of the killer is either the killer left something behind, clothes, shoes, something like that, because he would have been covered in blood. And this is definitely a man. So finding something like that, finding evidence of fighting back, DNA under the fingernails, tissue, hair under the fingernails of any of the victims is going to be their best chance. But you have to have something to compare that against. And if this person has never been arrested before, it doesn't do you much good until you have something to compare it against.
Until you have someone in custody where you could test that against the individual that's there. When it comes to something like this, and you have, and I asked this earlier on, one of my biggest questions was trying to discuss the logistics of what investigators are dealing with. And that's what I'm wondering is, when you have this substantial amount of blood and just this horrific crime scene, and investigators go in to get a sample of that, are we talking a small little sample from the scene, or are they processing these bodies in whole and all the blood that's been found on the ground? I mean, is that even something that is doable?
That's a great question.
To take all of that.
Tony, that is a great, insightful question. And I think the dynamic of it is, the first thing we have to remember is that those first responders from this police department are just human beings.
Yeah.
And they're going to be going through a lot of pressure. And I would even dare to say some of the investigators might even be having some traumatic emotional reaction to this, you know, and not having experienced this. Nothing can prepare you for the scene. No number of training classes, no number of forensic classes can prepare you for the first time you walk into this kind of a scene. Nothing can prepare you. So they're going through a difficult time. They don't have a whole lot to rely upon, hopefully. But here's the answer to your question. The answer is yes, I think you have to sample them in full. You need to take all of the bed sheets. You need to remove the bed, the comforter. You need to look for any evidence that could have been brought into that environment. And not knowing these people, it's going to be difficult for them to tell, is this something that was already there?
Yeah.
Or is this something that was left? So that's a tremendous challenge because we have no survivors except for the two folks that were on the first floor, which also, short of anything else, are probably our best lead right now. But to answer your question is, I think they're processing large quantities of the items in there. They have no capability to process that at their police department.
Sure.
They have some state laboratories that they can deal with, but it's collecting the evidence on the ground at that scene, which would have, in my opinion, taken a dozen people over a period of a week to just collect it and document it and taken thousands of photographs. Both at a distance, intermediate, and at scale, and marking it in the scene. They're going to need to bring in a 3D laser scanner. I would think before they moved anything, they should have brought in a 3D laser scanner and did a 3D Lycro laser scan of the entire second floor, first floor, third floor, front yard, backyard, that whole thing. Should have had an immediate 3D laser scan, because then you let the investigators go in and start sampling the blood, sampling the clothing, sampling any evidence on the floor, the garbage, all of that, the field behind the house. Because there's nothing to say that this person left in a car and came there in a car. Mm-hmm. You know, this person could have came on foot and left on foot.
Sure.
This is a big scene. And it's extremely complicated with overlapping, interspersing evidence, some of which could be very transitory in nature, meaning that it only has quantitative value for a short period of time before it expires.
And how difficult would it be to find evidence in a home that was such a come-and-go party house, such as the one that we've seen? One would imagine there would be a lot of DNA all over that place. And many of it, not the residents, but certainly much of it also not the killer either.
Right. Or, you see, there. That's the problem when you have such an uncontrolled environment. You know, this isn't a single family home with a husband and wife and a child and you know, maybe every once in a while the babysitter comes over. Yeah. You know, there's dozens of people coming through here every day. I think it's a monumental task, and I do not envy them. You know, I mean, I equate this to the complex level because of what they're looking for. This is as complex as, you know, putting together an airplane accident, but just at this scale because of, you know, the blood and what you're looking for. You're literally looking for a needle in a haystack, DNA amongst gallons of blood, a couple of droplets, or a hair fiber that doesn't match. Mm-hmm. But that might not even be indicative unless it's, you know, unless you can find a hair fiber that's, you know, somewhere so embedded in the scene that you can have a direct proximal geographical relationship of it to the event itself. Meaning, you know, what if the attacker bit the victim and there's a piece of the victim in the attacker in the a piece of the a killer in the attacker's mouth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just so horrific. And I don't want to get into the murder porn sure. territory because that's yeah. one of the things that I always, you know, yeah. on other things, I criticize other programs for that. And I'm not trying to be that
sure.
way.
It's just, it's logistics that we're discussing. Yeah. Really. We're not trying to be gross yeah. or be disrespectful by any means, but these are all things yeah. that the investigators certainly have to take into consideration.
Right.
When you have something like this, and we're talking about defensive wounds, obviously the first thing that comes to mind is fingernails and, you know, maybe yeah. you know, they scratch somebody and that would certainly get some DNA. But let's say they don't have that. We haven't heard anything either way on this, so we really don't know. But they said defensive wounds. Would a defensive wound, let's say there's some bruising on an arm or something that would have rubbed up against this individual. If someone's arm, for example, or hand rubbed up against another individual's flesh, now if someone is in a coat or something, there's probably not a lot of DNA there to be rubbing against. But if, right. if they did get a physical, just a rub against someone on that wound, would that contain the DNA of the individual, or would that not be a very reliable source of DNA to take a look at?
Well, I think you're going to have a difficult time pulling clean DNA samples amidst all that blood.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the hand, you have the best chance. But there's also another aspect of it as well. If this is obviously an edged weapon, so you could look for, and it was an edged weapon that was used on multiple occasions with people that could be fighting back. And the one thing with an edged weapon that an edged weapon does not do well when it comes in contact with is bone and metal and things like that. So if during the defensive process, you know, a femur went up to block the knife, mm-hmm. you know, you could have a chip of the knife come off in the wound.
Okay.
And then you could do a molecular test of, well, what kind of a knife is it? Where is this knife from? And more importantly, you could have a defect from the knife that you could compare with a knife that is recovered. But that's if you recover the knife. I think right now that knife is at the bottom of a very deep, cold lake.
Yeah. When it comes to taking DNA samples from people in the area, we earlier heard the neighbor who had a lot of people making accusations. I mean, I think almost everyone who knew these people at some point now has had some sort of ridiculous accusation levied against them yeah. online, which is horrible. But he was one who immediately stepped forward and said, take my DNA, do whatever you need to show that I have nothing to do with this. And we don't necessarily know, because no one has come forward and said that the FBI or the investigators have asked for their DNA. Is it an advantage to ask basically everyone in the circle to get their DNA now? They have it yes. basically as a grounding space. So when they do start going through things, and if they do start finding DNA in the house, and it says, well, we found your DNA here, they can match that against the individual and go, there's evidence they weren't even there. So that DNA must have, you know, been there from a party or something of that nature. Do we know it? Would it be standard practice for them to have already done that by now and we just don't know about it?
Well, I don't know if that's standard practice, but nothing about this case calls for standard practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that, and this is not a criticism of the police department, or maybe in a way it is, but the fact that everybody was told to go home and do online learning, I think that was a huge mistake.
Yeah,
I think also telling everybody that they're safe and don't worry about it, I think that's also a big mistake. I think that they should have had a roll call in school. They should have had a roll call at the fraternity, a roll call at the sorority. From everybody registered at that school, including employees, teachers, service people, food workers, everyone, come up and do a head count on that Monday. Let's see your hands. Let's see your face and get an eyeball on everybody. And who's not there?
Yeah.
I want to know who's not coming to school on Monday. But since 50% of the class was essentially dismissed because of grievance, which I understand, that's the emotionally good thing to do.
Sure.
But I think that, that caused everybody to disperse. And most likely the killer, if he was a student, they're going to go online or it's just too stressful and they're out of Dodge. You can't control the situation. Now, is that standard? No, it's probably not standard. You know, can you call for the students to come up and voluntarily give their DNA and blood samples? Yeah, you can voluntarily ask people to voluntarily do that,
mm-hmm.
but you can't compel them to do that. That's sure. against the Constitution. But if you had a call to action and say, hey, everybody come over and drop off your fingerprints, everybody come over and do a DNA and a spit and a hair, and thank you for your time, you know? And if somebody doesn't do that, that doesn't mean they're guilty. But I think then you can look at, well, why?
And I think that's a valid question, the well, why area of it. And I think that there's a lot of confusion out there and understanding of exactly what DNA samples do, what kind of evidence it provides in a case like this. Do you feel or have you seen in past investigations people fearful of giving their DNA for fear of being wrongly accused because they may have been in the wrong place at the wrong time, or they know that they were in that house and maybe they used some of the cups there and their DNA could be on that, or they slept in a bed there and their DNA could be there. And they're fearful of, I know I didn't do anything, but I also don't want to be the scapegoat when they really need to find a killer here. Is some of that going on in this case, you think?
Yeah, I think to a degree it is, but it takes a village, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It takes a village, and I'm a man of faith. I believe in God, and I believe in my fellow man, and the world that I want to live in is a world where people will step up and do the right thing to exclude themselves to make the investigation go easier.
Yeah.
But that's not the kind of world we live in. We live in a selfish world where people are worried about, well, I might get busted because I was on tape doing drugs, or I might get busted because I was with this guy and I should have been with this guy, or whatever the situation that has nothing to do with the murder, but could infringe upon somebody's personal character. Right. I think that's what's preventing people from participating fully. And that's a shame because that's selfish.
Sure.
That's the world we live in, Tony.
Another thing that has come up in the last couple of days and something I've been fairly critical of is they've just now started to take a look at some of the security footage from businesses that obviously had security cameras, prominent businesses such as this gas station, that the overnight clerk took the initiative to take a look at the tape and discovered, oh, there was a white car that drove by about 3:45 in the morning, somewhat matching the description of what they are looking for. One would wonder early on in this, why were they not going around and taking a look at things like the footage from a gas station, from the other countless businesses in the area that would likely have a camera on. And not necessarily that you're just going to find a car, but maybe you'll find somebody pumping gas. Maybe you'll find somebody going into the store, things of that nature, where would also then lend itself to find possible DNA had they looked at it earlier on. But now we're 5 weeks in, and likely the contamination level would be atrocious from people in these locations, and all that would be lost by now.
Yeah. Ephemeral nature of the evidence. I know it's a little cliche, but the first 48, 72 hours of investigation are absolutely critical for this evidence that is only available for a short period of time in an uncontaminated manner. And of course, that's what you want to do. You want to track down those leads as fast as possible. But these people, I think, when I say these people, I mean law enforcement, were already over thin.
Sure.
My understanding is that the University of Idaho does not have campus police, and the city of Moscow provided security not only for the 11,000 full-time residents, but also for the 11,000 part-time transient residents at the university. And, I don't know if their police department is 20 people for that size of a city, that's not nearly enough people to do all of the things that we're talking about doing. I think the FBI should have been involved on day one. This is over the head of a local police, and it's no slight against the Moscow Police Department. God bless them. They're doing the best they can, and I know they all have good intentions, but there's just not enough of them that have done this for decades and decades. At the FBI, they have the best technology, laser scanners. They have high-tech equipment. They can come in and paint that scene, collect it, bag it, analyze it in 72 hours, and they have enough personnel to do it. And unfortunately, it's not any fault of their own. No community of 22,000 people expects something like this to happen.
Sure, and I completely agree. I don't think anyone on the police force, at least as we know now, we're trying to do anything nefarious. Everyone's trying to do based on what they know. And unfortunately, and I guess unfortunately, in the same point in many small towns, thank goodness that this isn't a frequent occurrence, but it did indeed occur, and they just wouldn't have the expertise or experience to truly know how to handle it. But all of that being said, we are 5 weeks in as of the point of this recording, and the local police is still the lead on this. Does that mean anything? The question I would have is, why is the FBI not the lead on this by now with those resources? Or is that just more kind of a formal declaration of who's doing what?
Well, that could be, a bit of a psyop to, in their mind, to say, hey, it's just us folks down here looking at this, and maybe the killer will get lazy. And if the killer thinks the FBI and the totality of their resources are coming down, that might, squeeze them, into hiding even further. I don't know what their motivation is, but I'm telling you, the FBI should have been lead on this right away. And maybe they didn't have jurisdiction, but you can make a very quick argument, because this is a border town with another state, that triggers FBI jurisdiction. And you need that kind of dragnet of a web. I mean, there should have been roadblocks up, highways shut down, APB, a profile right away, live TV the very next day. We're looking for a white male, 18 to 35, a loner, who's good with knives, who's strong, who might have injuries, who might be hiding, who might be trying to get away. They might be acting weird. They might be funny. They might have done this before. But that's who we're looking for. Somebody who's throwing away clothes, somebody in a Hyundai or a black SUV. Is anybody in your family acting funny right now? Is anybody in your family have injuries? Look at people's hands and faces for scratches and bruises. That's what I would have said in the first 24 hours. And everybody in that community, you're like, okay, well, who's not here? Yeah. And then those are the leads that you want. but they're so afraid at the beginning. And I see this a lot, and I don't know why. I think maybe it's because they, you know, it's old fashioned thinking to protect the data of the crime. But for the most part, the community wants to help you. And if you give the community the tools, well, then you have all of these investigators out there helping you. And yeah, it's difficult because sometimes you have people throwing a monkey wrench in that don't know what they're doing. But I think, you know, having a see something, say something press conference and giving people, I mean, we know, listen, this is a white guy between 18 and 35. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. And unfortunately, after 5 weeks, this case, you know, you want to look at who's not there anymore, who's left the country, you know, who's no longer living in their on-campus housing. You know, I highly doubt that this was more than one person as well, although of course it could be a possibility. But to get one person, to have one person, you see, this case is such a contradiction to me. And I'll tell you why. And I don't want to go over long too much because I'm probably not answering your direct question. But here's the contradiction I see in this case. When you look at this case, four people butchered with an edged weapon, you think it's a madman. And most madmen get caught right away because they're madmen. The contradiction is here. This is a madman act that was done cool, calm, collected, premeditated, and they got away. So how much of a madman is it really?
Yeah,
it's a contradiction.
I agree. I mean, it, at first the thought was, well, maybe this is kind of a loner that, you know, kind of knew them in a circle. But you know, maybe, and this is just my thoughts on it, because we've never gotten a profile released to us by law enforcement saying, look out for this type of person. It's just, we don't know. But almost anyone could have, with some profiling experience, could say this is likely who you're looking for, like you just did.
Yeah.
When you have something like this, and there's this profile out there, this assumption that maybe it was somebody that was in the circle of students, maybe was rejected by one of them, something of that nature, and had this anger, had this hate for them, and impulsively came in and did this. I don't know how, if you were impulsively doing that, you would think there'd be a lot of things that they would have screwed up and would have been caught already. This feels, the longer this goes on, more like very premeditated and someone who knows their way around a crime scene and knows how to get out undetected.
I absolutely agree with you, Tony. If this was a student or a jilted lover or something like that, or somebody who was rejected with some irrational, you know, thought process, thought that they felt jilted in some dramatic way. But then that crime of passion, that excited delirium of the act, always, almost 99.999% of the time, that act of passion, of maniac attitude, that's where they mess up. The same thing that allows them to do the crime is the same thing that gets them busted for the crime. So you're right. This was premeditated. You know, this person could have been lying in wait for them to get home.
I mean, in theory, yes, knowing that the home was very easy to get into and many people knew multiple ways of entering the home. Where we're at right now, this far into an investigation, and you've seen many, many investigations throughout the course of your career. We are 5 weeks in. They do not have any public-facing suspects to talk about, and there really hasn't been a lot of discussion of DNA evidence. Are we statistically looking at something where this is likely to go cold at some point?
I think if it hasn't already gone cold, you know, you might get lucky a year down the road, 2 years down the road, and something happens. But for something this dramatic to take place and have no leads, you know, to me, I just have this feeling it's unless sophisticated, experienced, you know, detectives come in and take a lead on this case. Either this person somehow messes up on their own and reveals their identity, but the chances of the law enforcement tracking this person down in any timely manner is difficult at this point. I don't have a whole lot of confidence. And I hope I'll be the first person to say, hey, Scott Roeder was wrong. They busted the guy tomorrow. Sure. When I wake up and have my coffee, I'd be happy as can be. Yeah. And I'll eat that crow every day. But my gut tells me this is going to be a hard case to crack in the next year. At this point,
the law enforcement, when they've made statements, it's obviously very positive, forward looking of, we feel we're going to get this person. There's a lot of things behind the scenes that you don't know about. That's the speech. That's what they're saying. But then what we're seeing when someone does come forward, such as the gas station attendant who said, hey, I got this video here, come take a look. They literally shut the gas station down 5 weeks after this. It's been actively used by patrons for 5 weeks. And it's over a video camera and a videotape that they are welcome to have. But they shut it down. They disassemble one of the gas pumps. I'm assuming, my guess would be the card reader camera that might be in there that they're going to take a look at to see if there's anything there. Yeah. But to shut something down and act that dramatically, that tells me that, okay, they're saying this, but here's what they're actually doing. It doesn't lead to a lot of confidence, I think, in the general public or of the families, more importantly, that they have a whole lot that they're going on if this is how they're handling someone saying, hey, I got a videotape here, and they shut down the whole gas station for days on end. I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not that expert in that, but it's just observational, and I'm kind of shocked at what a lot of us have observed and assume was being done that has not been done.
Yeah, I think shutting down a gas station 5 weeks after it happened is utterly pointless. You know, my understanding is they said they might have seen a white car. I mean, listen, a white Hyundai is one of the most popular cars in America.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if that necessarily has a whole lot of, and maybe at the moment, if we could have augmented that video, grabbed the license plate, seen the occupants in the vehicle, if they were just passing by, you're not going to be able to see that. But if a white Hyundai got gassed there, yeah, you can go back to that day and just pull the record and see how it was paid for.
Sure.
Or if they came inside to pay for it in cash, well, you got them on camera there, right? That's not that big of a deal. That's not even a forensic situation. That's just, you know, matching what you find up on the video and on the tape to whoever bought the gas, right? But if it's just a car passing in the background, I find it it's unrealistic to think that's going to have probative value. Now, to me, I like going a little bit more old school than that. I would have liked to see the very next day at 11 a.m. Since you got everybody on lockdown, the very next day at 11 a.m. Give me 10 bloodhounds.
Yeah.
Give me 10 bloodhounds and have them smell some of the items in that house. And then you walk those bloodhounds through that entire campus.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, I want to see something like that going on. Those dogs can pick up a scent and hold on to it. You know, I'm a proud owner of a German short-haired pointer who, you know, did some time in her life, you know, providing, smelling expertise and cadaver recovery. Those dogs have an amazing ability to pick up on scents of anybody who was in that apartment.
Yeah.
That day, anybody in that house that day, you know, that dog is going to be able to take you to doors, and you can knock on doors. And that's not a technology kids can avoid. You know, they know how to, delete their Snapchat and, you know, delete their Venmo transactions and delete their, their websites and whatnot. But you can't run from a dog's nose. And this case is very much physical evidence. And unfortunately, if that stuff's not done right when it happens, you're going to have a hard time picking up the scent.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy for us on the sidelines to be critical of the investigation and of the police and look at hindsight and say, you should have done this, you should have done that. Obviously, it doesn't affect anything going forward because these are the facts. This is reality. This is how it was conducted. And again, very likely bit lack of experience and lack of knowing how to handle a case like this within 24 to 48, 72 hours. But with all that being said, people speaking out about this, it makes one angry. I mean, obviously, I'm just watching from the sideline here. I can't imagine the outrage that we've seen from Steve Gonsalves and other parents haven't been as vocal as him, but that frustration, it must be completely overwhelming to look at some of these steps that seem to be fairly obvious, honestly, to the average Dateline watcher were not even taken into account in this investigation. Is DNA something you think that will solve this case? Is that something that will be needed to solve this case this far in now?
Absolutely. Yeah. Hopefully, these are all young kids, right? And, they all had that fight or flight or freeze mentality when they were confronted by this, I'm going to say godless person. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be DNA and tissue under somebody's fingernails. It could be Ethan. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that there's some reports that Ethan was the one that was not in the bed, meaning he might have been, and I've had this happen before here in this case I'm working on right now, where two people just randomly sitting there at a park bench for no reason, they get shot in the back of the head. The man always gets attacked first because you take out the threat, right? So, sure.
And we don't know we don't know that is factually what happened in this case right now. I just want to state that, but you're speaking based on experience and trend, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, just based on experience. And you're right, we don't know any of that yet. But it's likely that if the attacker came in on that second floor area through the glass windows or snuck through that first floor through the door and got past the sleeping people plus the dog, and then they were alerted on that second floor, somebody would have fought back, whether it was the two girls upstairs or Ethan and Zaina on the second floor, because they did have defensive wounds. I think the best chance is going to be one of them fought back enough to get some DNA under their fingernails or in some other manner on their body. Something was deposited that will be linked DNA-wise to the killer. But that's only good if you have something to compare it against.
Yeah.
It's a year from now or somebody that's previously in custody. That is going to be the case unless a family member gives up a suspicious person.
Or if they strike again somewhere and aren't as lucky and leave some evidence behind and are arrested on another crime. And then they can compare that to the DNA in this case and find a killer. That's how we're finding so many now, as you sure are. We're very well aware of where we're having so many individuals who are in their 70s, 80s being arrested for murders committed 50, 60 years ago.
Killers being exonerated for that very same reason.
Scott Roeder, evidence specialist with Evidence Room Forensic Reconstruction in Cleveland. Thank you so much for joining us and adding your insight into this conversation. Thank you for listening to the program. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any episodes of the show. This is a production of the podcast True Crime Today. You can also follow True Crime Today wherever you download podcasts. Get updates on this case and many other true crime cases on True Crime Today. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening to Four Killed for What.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.